Hello, everyone. Welcome to the fourth episode of Career Mode podcast. I have with me Mike the Cracker. We've met a few years ago, and I've been able to follow his path into the pro level in Europe. He's currently in the Netherlands. He'll speak more about that in a minute. But it's really great to have you here, Mike. I think it will be very interesting for any coach to see the transition and to keep following your path, because I'm sure from here only good and better things will happen. So welcome.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me, Diogo. Yeah, we met a couple of years ago at a camp in Belgium, back when we actually weren't affiliated with the camp whatsoever. We were just two coaches hungry for more knowledge and went out of our country to get the knowledge. Yeah, so that's how it all started. Right now I'm coaching in the Netherlands at Heroes Den Bosch, a pro team out here. And yeah, it's been like a fabulous journey I've made so far in this pro team, but also like a roller coaster in terms of the career path and where I am today. I'm very lucky.
For sure. No, great memories I have from Belgium and from sharing the court with you, also with Francesco that we had here already. And yeah, so really, really good stuff. So maybe let's give some context to anyone listening, because when we met, I believe you were still working in the Netherlands, right?
Yeah.
And in between, you also work for Elite Academy afterwards, after that camp.
Afterwards, yeah.
So it's been a really roller coaster, as you said, but I met you as a part-time coach, I believe. And in the
not even amateur.
Yeah. So tell me how has that happened? How was the process? Because I believe you haven't played to a high level like me. I mean, I haven't either. So
you played at a high level. So in my youth, I played at the highest level in the Netherlands for a couple of years, one or two maybe. But I chose to pursue my study. And I already knew I was not good enough to make it pro. So like that was for me like, okay. So I went back to my hometown. I went to study there at the university. Played in a local team, which also played at like the second amateur level. So still a decent level. Met very good friends out there, and I was always interested in coaching. So back in the days, I was already coaching teams over there, and that's actually how I came in contact with EA, with Elite Academy. Sorry, Elite Athletes at that moment, because they were at Belgium Coaches Clinic, and we saw them there, kept in touch, and eventually I went there with a couple of my players to the camp that also hosted Diogo and others like Francesco and Alex. That was a very interesting and very high-level camp I learned a lot in. After that, I also did a trainer's course in the Netherlands. So that's the highest one. I needed to have a better surrounding, let me say it like that, because the level I was coaching in the Netherlands at that moment wasn't high enough. So via Alex, I was able to do an internship with EA. And after that, I became a head coach out there as well. That was part-time. And I decided to pack myself, sell my house, and move to Belgium. Well, we all know what happened last season. So we were able to start the season, but COVID struck. So we were also in some sort of lockdown in which sport was not allowed inside. And at one point, like after that whole season, we still were following the trainer's course in the Netherlands, and I was really interested in one assignment, which was a video scouting assignment, and that was done by a head coach named Erik Braal, and a good friend of him who was also his former assistant coach, Meinert van Veen. And they hosted it, and they had some tasks that we had to do up front. I really enjoyed it in that like coaches clinic that we had for the trainers course. I presented my stuff afterwards. Clinic or story, coaches clinic was done. And a couple months later, I got a message from that coach because he was going to do the national under 16 team men of the Netherlands, asking me if I was interested in potentially joining him as an assistant coach with the national under 16 team. At that point, we didn't know if the Dutch Federation was going to the European Championships because of the whole situation. I after a couple meetings, we watched some video. We had a lot of good talks about basketball. We decided to virtually shake hands and started the whole program. Of course, the Netherlands, we didn't participate in the alternative Euros. So we only had a 5-week program, but really had good contact with the coach, and he was going to a new club. So he was going to Heroes Den Bosch. And at one point, he asked me if I was interested in possibly joining the application process and in becoming an assistant coach out here. And I never forget that moment. I forgot that whole moment because I never forget that I forgot that whole moment because that conversation for me, it was like one blur in my mind. Like I through COVID, we have met so many times also with COVID, with the whole situation. Me and another coach, Dennis, we were hosting calls where we met so many good coaches. So many friendships built over that period. So I was always trying to improve myself. And after such a short journey through Belgium, the Netherlands, I found myself in a place that I was in the process of applying for a job that's a full-time position. We all know how the application process turned out. Otherwise, I would not be sitting here. So, the full-time position is also based on the fact that I'm an assistant with the first team, but also head coach of the academy, which houses the under 14, under 16, under 18, and under 22 men. And therefore, I'm also head coach of the under 22. And I've said it many, many times before, I'm such lucky to be in this position and so thankful for this chance, because I think I have a job that might not even be a handful of persons that have that job in the Netherlands, being a full-time AC. So
that's really great.
Very thankful.
That it's really great, the perspective you're showing. And also, I mean, the name of the podcast is Career Mode, also because I'm super interested in discovering how other people, you know, find their ways to become a professional, or not really, because not everyone is made for that, and not everyone wants it even. But I think there is tremendous value on your experience. And actually, I mean, for sure, you said it already, and you're grateful for that. But it happened everything so fast, right? from selling the, like, I bet you still think selling the house happened yesterday, right?
For sure. For sure. Yeah. And now I'm living in Den Bosch. So it was going so fast. And now in the pro life as well, it's like going here 2 games a week with the pros because of the new formula with the BNX League. We're playing European, of course. So we also in the FIBA Europe Cup. So yeah, we have so many good games.
So many stuff to talk about as well. So maybe coming back to what you're saying, transition to pro. So what is it I assume you're assistant coach, you're responsible for the scouting. So maybe let's dive in first there, and then we talk about the rest. So what is your main responsibility, and how are you finding the whole, you know, process of coming up with video? How do you do it? Like, how often do you have to do, how much work you have to do on that field? So maybe how's the balance between on-court stuff and you know, watching video?
Yeah. So normally, like let's say that we have just a normal week, and we should only have one game a week, because that's huge different, like if we have travel or not. But on a normal day, we would train twice a day. So that's morning and late afternoon practice. So that equals to, let's say, well, three and a half, four hours of training, like anywhere between 3 to 4 hours of training a day. So those trainings are mainly done by the head coach. So I might be in charge for the whole warm-ups, for example. And afterwards we go into the stuff that he wants to train. But as a, as part of my job is also video analyst and scouting. So most of the times I'm working either one or two games up front. So I'm checking out 2 to 3 games, downloading them, and putting them in our video software we use, which is Knox Sports. And I'm analyzing the games in that. So we're building presentations that we show to the team. So head coach showed me how to do it. He tasked me how to do it, and he tasked me with doing that. And I'm trying to do the best I can in that job and grow every second of it. So most of the times we call it tagging, but I'm tagging too much. Like then the feedback is, well, yeah, it's good enough. We have enough. Like, what clip do we want to pick? Because we have 10, I have 10 clips of that play or that person. Like, and he's like, well, we only need 2 or 3. So we better pick the good one. And I'm like, but they're all good.
Yeah. And so, and then on that part, because I assume you are responsible as well to come up with a video for the players. So not just for the head coach, or?
Yeah, so no, but it's actually the same. So what we do, like, we're working with Instep. The league is working with Instep. So yeah, we can download the games out of Instep, as well with all the tags that Instep already uses. So we incorporate that in our video software. And then we are making our own presentation. And first, like, I was building that scouting database in terms of building the video files. Together with the coach, we select the clips, and at first coach was presenting it to the players. Right now we're at a phase that I'm also able to present it to the players. So we both go through all the clips. So for example, let's say team A is playing with offense 1, 2, and 3. We go through all the clips. We're saying, okay, this is an important one, this. And those are the clips that we are going to present to the team. Then I'm building a playbook of it. So with FastRaw, I'm building a whole playbook of their offense. And we are presenting the clips to the players, sending the playbook. We all know, like everybody knows, that almost zero to none of the pros will read the playbook because they rather a video. But for us as coaches, for me as an AC, it's very important to build them and to have them with me to know what's coming.
And so, but then that really strikes me. So how do you, what's the balance there? Because, I mean, we all talk about how the attention span, as you kind of mentioned there, from the players is not so big and not as big as we would like to, of course. And at the same time, you have one game a week, potentially two now with the European competitions. So how what's the length, or what's the amount of information that you find that's like with the balance. And I also assume that not every player will be the same. So some players might request in some sort of way more information about their matchups or whatever. So what's the balance there? If you have found one already, or if not, just what's on your mind?
No, so we showed him a couple of clips. I think the length wise, so the amount of time the clips will take, I think it's around five, because we cut them up really, really tight. Like, it's not going to be going from the defensive part to the offense and then back to the defensive part, for example. It's just really tight. What are they running? How do they run it? And a lot of the players themselves also watch the games. Like, they also watch the opponents. So a lot of them, the players already have their matchup, so to say, in mind. Mm-hmm. And then in practice or the practice before, we play the game. I have the playbook with me. We're running over their plays. Players and coaches, we are saying, okay, how do we want to defend this? Players say, okay, we want to defend it with defense A or defense B. And then we kind of mutually agree to it, and then we move on, and we will play like that in the game.
Okay, no, nice. All right, makes sense. Thanks for asking. And so, and then I'll just come back to an important question, that just about the process that you choose to work individually. So, when you start the scouting for the next opponent, whatever, one or two games ahead, where do you start? Do you start individually looking at the players? Maybe who's the most, you know, important or most valuable player on the teams? Or do you start from a team perspective and then break it down to the single pieces?
Yeah. So, no, normally I start with team, their concepts, and how do they play? How do they defend? Like, can I get up? Can I get any signals? Because a lot of the teams also run a lot of set offenses. So, like, at first I want to see, okay, what are their team tendencies? So how do they play? Do they play fast, not fast? Like, will they pick up full court? Will they don't pick up full court? Are they going in zones? But most of the times I start with offense. So I start with our offensive videos, and I'm going through that, through the offenses, and looking for any play calls I can get. So I'm tagging all the offenses in terms of, like, all right, this is let's say a diamond setup with a side pick and roll into a flare action, for example, just saying something. That's how I tag the files. Like, that's how I tag that offense. If I find a play call, for example, it can be offense one. Mm-hmm. Offense one is their diamond. Then I'm making a new tab in the presentation. Okay, this is offense one, diamond. And then I'm putting in all the video that I found of offense one in that file. And that's just first I'm doing a rough sketch of what they are doing. And then we're going to look inside, and then I'm going to look inside, okay, is this good enough to show or not to show? Like, if it's not good enough to show, and I already think it's not good enough to show, definitely the head coach thinks it's not good enough to show, because he will say, okay, we only need so many clips, so definitely not. And then indeed you're looking at player tendencies. So, for example, in those plays, our player is running the play, or our player is reading the defense. Which player has tendencies that are, like, not common with the play they are running?
Yes.
Why does he go backdoor on that play? Why he should not be able to go backdoor on the play, because that was not the play, right? Yes. His defense was very, very high. Okay, does he do that once? Does he do that twice? Three times in a game? Okay, now we're getting to see tendencies, and then you're getting more into player-specific ones. Okay. And then you're focusing more on, okay, what are the tendencies of the top two, three players? And play with that.
Yeah, no, okay, that makes a lot of sense. And so moving from there, just to finish on the scouting topic, what's the process like from whatever you decide, you know, from a team basis, and also to show the players, to then to the court? Like, Do you run stuff through 5-on-0? Do you like what does it look like if I go and watch one practice of yours? That
no, like I... if we work on the scouting report, it will always be 5-on-5. So for example, you will just start out with the bench being in offense and then the starters being in defense. And just, okay, they're running offense one, which I just say, okay, offense one might be a diamond. So point guard is over here, maybe give a name to it. Like, okay, this is Diogo with the ball over there. Like really visualizing it for them because they just watched the video. They watched everything. So they know, okay, this is their point guard. This is their tendencies. This is Diogo. This is Mike. And just name the players. And then, okay, first they do this. They open up like this. This player's tendency is to go reject the ball screen every time. So watch for the reject. If not, he's coming over. We're doing this, this, and this. And then it's like, okay, how are we going to defend it? Players all openly, we all openly discuss. Okay, we're going to defend like this. Then we play live with that, switch teams, new offense, stuff like that.
And how rigid that makes sense. So, and how rigid do you have to be? Just because, I mean, I'm following here the pro team to play in the pro way. And so many times in practice, and I guess this happens everywhere, right? Even with youth teams, but you are going over the scouting or going over what the other guys do, and simply players, maybe offense in the example that you were explaining, they will go to what they prefer to do rather than the player that they are, you know, imitating or the player they are covering, let's say. So how rigid do you have to be to, you know, that he will look always for the reject first? So now, even though you don't like it, whatever, then you have to look for it. Is it hard to find that balance?
To be honest, I haven't thought about that so much because we really got a group of guys that is locked in what we are doing. Right. So they know at that part of the training, we are working to develop the defense for their offense and not to play offense like you should be.
Yeah.
Like, so we try not to do that. And to be honest, like I said, I haven't experienced any of that so far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great,
of course, it's still a reading game. So we still play like we should be. And if defense is giving you something or showing you something, then they're giving up something. So, of course, you want to punish it, but we also want to keep it between the boundaries of, like, how would they be playing? Like, just remember, you're Diogo, you're not Mike.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, yeah. Diogo is able to dunk. Mike's not able to dunk.
I wish. And so, and moving on from your role as assistant coach to what you've done, I mean, here you can take it as to what direction you prefer, but you've been with the national team, which was great, I assume, and even though you couldn't experience yet the European Championships, and you are as head coach of the under 22, which I assume you have a bunch of young guys as well. So what are the takeaways so far this season with the under 22 team?
So with the under 22 team, we we got two players that also joined the first team. So the two youth players. And then I got another group of guys going to go with that. So actually, like, you know, the style of play that we used to run, like the conceptual style of play that Alex really introduced me with. And I really like that style of play. So we are now 1-3 in the under 22 competition, in the under 22 division. We played against, like, we lost three times against the bigger and better teams, but we saw growth in every game. So I also said to the players when I called them and I asked them, like, how was last season? How did everything go? And, like, of course, I'm going to be a new coach. We couldn't have met because of the COVID rules, like, but I'm going to be a new coach, stuff like that. And I said, well, just trust me on this. It will take 2 to 3 months to really build and see something happen.
Yeah.
And I said, well, okay, yeah, we're going for that. Yeah. And you definitely saw it in our games. Like the first game, we were able to hang on for like 2 quarters. Now, second game, we're able to hang on for 3 quarters within the game.
Sure.
Third game, we were hanging there till the last couple minutes. And fourth game, we won easily. So we're already seeing big progress from all the guys. So it's coming together.
That's great. And so if anyone was to watch your under 22 team, what would they see in terms of conceptual offense? And so that would be the first question. And then what was the process like, or what is it going to be like since you started the season until now? Like, how was the implementation? How much did you show them? You know, what does it look like now?
Yeah, so I had a good talk with other people that came to watch my practice, as well as the coach, about situational leadership. Mm-hmm. So there are a couple of phases within that concept, and we're talking about the fact that although we're early in the process, I already let the players delegate a lot of things themselves, even though they might not be used to it, might not be the right time, because that's always the question: is it the right time to let the players delegate things themselves? And not handle it a little bit more directive. So a little bit more of, I want this, this, and this.
True.
And that's still a question that remains in my head. Like, what if I had done that? Would we be able to hang on for more times in the other, for longer times in the other games that we lost? Would we be able to win it? I think so. That would have been a better style if you wanted to look at the concepts. To the results. I have to say, like, that would have been a better style. But I think right now, with building that and letting them delegate as much of things as possible, it also learns them to take leadership. Mm-hmm. And now you are able to see, okay, I really do not play call or anything from the side. I mm-hmm. let them play, because we are building in our triggers. Like, we are building in our offenses, just starting with some concepts and playing off that, punishing, preventing coverages, running different actions, two-man games, three-man games, like pistols, adding new stuff that we see, and the guys implement it right away, and you just see like immediate results, and then you see, okay, well, they got confidence in what we were doing. So yeah, if you would have come to a practice right now, it would be a messy environment, which a lot of things happen on court.
Yeah.
And a lot of moments where I'm like taking a step back, let them be messy, but still find the sweet spots to coach in. And then that's still a process that I'm learning.
Sure.
Because I'm a coach that loves to talk, if you haven't figured that out yet. So when to say something and when to keep my mouth shut in practice is also an important one.
Sure. Well, no, that makes a lot of sense, and it's interesting to see that this conceptual offense is being more and more you know utilized, and for sure not everything is going to work perfectly in the beginning, but that's interesting. Actually, I relate a lot to what you're saying or what you mentioned about. Giving the players, you know, pass the ball to the players, let's say, or the hot potato, and they have to come up with not just the answers, but the whole, you know, all the concepts. So that makes sense. Here in Nuremberg, we talk a little bit about, you know, maybe if we, like you said, if we were explicit on what we wanted and this is what we do and that's it, then it would very likely, you know, we would win. The structural would win over creativity, right? But just on the short term. And so if you build on, like, and make the players think and reflect on what they are doing, how they should do it and what they should do it, then maybe you win more over, you know, creativity over structure, because you end up asking or hopefully trying to make the right questions, and then the players, you know, might find other solutions, and in the end, you just want the solutions, right? It doesn't matter if it's our way or if they find a better solution, then that works, right?
No, and also like for example, we saw a lot of shows and hard hatches in the early games, and we already put an emphasis on in the practices even before that on short rolls and weak side cuts. Not even weak side ghost cuts, because the weak side corner is over helping so much in those games that it's not even a ghost cut, because you're open either way. If you stay in the 3-point line, you're open. If you cut down, you're open. So, but rather have a layup than have that 3-pointer. So working on that, and then in the first couple of games, one or two games, not at start, like in the first game, we didn't have that much cuts because we weren't able to recognize it. Second game, we already got like 3-4 cuts out of it, so it's already 8 points. Third game, we're even doing better. And now in our last game that we won, we kept cutting, and we had so many points. Like,
yeah,
just in the beginning, we already had, like in the first quarter, we might already had like 10 points out of cuts, and that kept growing the whole game. And to build on what you're saying as well, is like, how do we give feedback? Because still, that's a thought that wanders in my mind all the time. Like, what am I saying, and is what I am saying also feedback, or is it just acknowledging something that I've seen?
Yes. Yeah.
And I think out here in general in the Netherlands, a lot of people want to hear that, like, good pass, Diogo, or good shot, Diogo, but what am I really saying to you? I'm saying nothing to you. Like, you also know that it's a good shot. You know that was a shot you were able to make. But what happened before? What was the decision leading up to the shot? Were you screened? Were you making some sort of movement to get open? Because that's the decision we have to get feedback on.
Yes, yes. And
like, we are used, and players are used to get feedback on those kind of actions, and they're asking for it or looking for that, like that good feeling, yes or no feeling, instead of what's the decision? Was the decision good enough?
Yes, and that makes a lot of sense, and also that just made me thought that so many times we provide feedback, even if it made in, you know, a question base, you know, like there was a mistake, a player missed the pass. So asking what did they see, like why did they make that pass, why it might not have worked. So making them find solutions. But also so many times we, like, let's say that pass went well, you know, and I think the first base, at least the way I put it, you just say good job. And so the player doesn't really know what the good job was for, right? The pass, the footwork, what was it? And then, so I think that the next step, of course, is to be specific on what you say. But so many times, and especially working with youth, I find that, you know, yeah, good pass, but the player doesn't know why it was a good pass. Maybe he just tried a new, you know, a new technique or whatever. He just tried it, but he doesn't have, he's not able yet, because it's totally normal. It's something that takes a lot of time and effort to recognize why the pass was successful. So not only when the mistakes happen, but why was it successful? So maybe he had tried that same pass before and didn't work. So now you have to look at it and understand, okay, this time it got, like the pass was successful because the defender was, you know, over helping on the cut, whatever the circumstances. So I don't know, do you reflect on that? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, for sure. And I also like was able to get feedback on myself as a coach that, for example, one of the mistakes that I made or make is the fact that if I want to hear something, I'm asking it in a negative way. So for example, on a fast break scenario, and like we look to play a two-side break, and somebody else is just randomly cutting inside, then I'm asking the player, what do we don't want to do, instead of asking it with positive feedback. So instead of like, so that's a negative formulation of the question. And I was thinking about it. Yeah, I'm doing that a lot. I'm doing that. Sometimes, not all the times, but sometimes when I really want something to be seen, then I'm asking it in a negative way. And then that's why am I not keep asking it in a positive way? Why am I asking it in a negative way?
Yes, yes.
That was a question I couldn't even answer myself.
Yeah, no, I definitely relate to that, because at least it happened a couple of weeks here with me, that because I'm with you, right? We know that asking in a positive way and making the players reflect and all those things are super important, especially on the long run, right? You won't get the results out of that so soon. But if you do it over time, the players will get very, you know, reflective, and maybe we'll have to stop asking questions because they do it already. But when you are in moments of pressure or when it's really what you need or what you want to do as a coach, then it's hard to stop ourselves to do it, because you come back to your maybe habits, you know, the direct way. So that really, I really relate with that topic. It's something, you have to be mindful of what you're doing, of every question, every feedback you give.
Yeah. So in that objective, in that, like, how am I asking stuff? I really think about that. Like, what am I asking and how am I asking it? And how do we react on certain stuff? Because I find myself too much times, I found myself, not really right now, but I found myself visually complaining about decision being made. So we all know the coaches that if somebody's throwing a turnover, or like, I'm not saying it, but you know, all those nonverbal cues also show something about a person, also may also have influence on the players. So, like, even though it's a really messed up situation, and even though the outcome is a turnover or whatever, if the decision was good, then we can look back and give positive feedback on the decision. If the decision is not good, because it's not that I'm cheering for every wrong decision. If the decision is not good, we have to be short on that negative feedback, and we have to be long in positive feedback and as short as possible in negative feedback.
For sure, that really relates. I mean, it's hard because often, you know, when you are negative, you know, let's say you lost a game and then you come back to the next week of practice and you, let's say you are more negative than the usual, it seems like things get on track, you know, it seems like you have a positive result. I'm still not 100% if that's really true, or is it just what happens, or you know, the natural way of happening, because you had a bad game, so you know, it's the next one is more likely to go well, you know, just from a statistical point of view, right? But at the same time, for me, the challenge right now a little bit is that I try to be positive and try to not show frustration and all those things. But some players that are not used to it, they see it as you are not so rigid or not so demanding of them, you know, because you're complaining less with them. And in reality, I'm just trying to help them more to keep them on a positive mindset. But if you don't, so right now I struggle with that balance, because some players see that negative, you know, frustration or what, or complaining as a demanding coach. And so they see it as in a positive way, let's say. And it's a hard balance, at least for me.
But it's also just about being honest. And what I mean by being honest, for example, the third game that we lost out here with under-22s, I think we should not have lost that one, but I think that loss was on me. And also just being honest to the players. Like at first, when I contact them and I reach out to them and I call the players, I was also talking about like, okay, how are you? How was the previous coaches? Like, how is your experience? And like, how am I as a person and a coach? And that was one of the first things I also acknowledged in first person in-person introductions. And after that, like I said, that third game, I was giving too much signals to the guys, too much stuff that was not like it was just too much information to the guys.
Yeah.
So a lot of the information got lost in the process in that clutch situations, which resulted in some easy baskets by the opponent because the players were not performing the defensive task because I was too much giving them too much information. So their defensive tasks were not like they didn't receive their defensive task well enough. And that's on me. That's not on the players. I can say, oh, you guys didn't listen or you guys didn't do that. Or no, it's on me. And that's the first thing that I said in the locker room. Like I say, this one is on me. I wasn't bringing my A game because I gave you too much information. And that's not because you cannot handle it, but it's a mistake on my part for giving it. And that also gives them the feeling that they are in a safe environment. Like yes. They can make mistakes.
Yeah.
Because how many times we give the players we say it's the players' wrongdoing for something that ends up.
Yes.
And how many coaches are willing to admit to the players that, guys, this one is on me. I effed it up.
Yeah. No, for sure. And also shows, you know, that the ecosystem to the players, it's a fair one, you know, it's fair because they make mistakes the same way we do it. And the same way, you know, later on, a ref might do it too, you know, and very likely to do it as well. So I think that's a good approach to have it. Mike, like, thanks a lot. As you know, I try to keep it as short as possible. So going now to the last two, you know, two questions, two brief ones. So the first one is because in the beginning of our call, we were talking about, managing, I think you said this. So your hobby became your profession, which is amazing, but at the same time, it's very risky. By the way, I love the phrase. But so what are the best ways for you, you know, to get that balance? So what are you doing? So this is a non-basketball question. So I'll give you maybe 3-4 options of how you would spend your night or whatever, your free day, if you have any. So either watching the Netflix series on your couch, going out with friends, you have an option. So I'll give you a third option that you can choose, or just let's say going to the park with, alone reading. So what's your option?
Yeah, no, to be fair, like if we have a day off with the pro team, most likely I don't have a day off with the academy. Then the practice, for example, is beginning of the evening after school for the guys. So that means I have some hours off, so to say, instead of coming in the office in the morning, starting with video and stuff like that. So most of the times when I take an afternoon off, or sorry, not taking an afternoon off, when I have a morning off, or for example, you have something like that, I really try not to be involved in basketball. It's also something that I have been taught to do when I started out here, like you said, like and what I said before, like my hobby became my profession. So what's left of your hobby? Because we're all crazy about the sports that we are in basketball, and I'm one of the lucky few or the lucky ones that is able to make a living out of it. But what else do you have? Like, what can you fall back on? So if possible, then I go visit friends, family back in my hometown.
Okay.
If not, I'm just trying to relax. So indeed, then I'm going for option A. Most likely I'm binge watching a series that has been on my watch list.
Yeah.
Or spend some time reading. But knowing me, if I started to read, like, for example, the Doug Liemhoff book, just give me 3 pages and I'm already done, because then I already need to write. I already need to write. And so then I have to read something that's not basketball or something that my cognitive capacity is not, should not be involved in it.
Yeah, and for people that don't know you or that is the first time listening to you, and I think it's possible to see as well during this episode, you are a guy that's conscious about what you're doing, you know, and reflect. So So it's like your mind is always, you know, always thinking about something. So yeah. it's important to really try to get away, to let your mind rest a little bit. Of course, never yeah. too much, but so I like the option A for sure. And then yeah. last question, because you've been, of course, in the Netherlands, you had a short trip in Belgium, but now the league is together between Netherlands and Belgium, right? And also you are starting with the FIBA Europe Cup that you just defeated my home team, so Benfica. Great game, by the way. But so what is something that you've taken from other cultures? And I mean, you can take this question from any perspective, basketball and non-basketball stuff, but you've also grown your network, I believe, so much during lockdown. You know, it was one of the yeah. positive things, let's say, if there's any. And you did your episode, you did many Zoom calls that I've been, like, I was able to learn so much. So what is something that you've taken from someone else, you know, from other cultures?
Yeah. So for sure. And like during my stay in Belgium, I learned so much of Alex, of course. Yeah, you know him as well, like Alex Rama. He doesn't need any introduction whatsoever on that topic of conceptual offense. No, but I learned a ton of him, but also a ton of the other guys. And then I think that's also something that I bring to the Netherlands right now. It's just being able to have friends that also love the game outside of Netherlands, outside of Belgium, outside of Europe, because the game is so different over there.
Yeah.
And I think I can learn from everybody, even from players as well. So that's something that I bring into a Dutch culture, which is not that much on basketball, even though we have like one of the tallest. Our country is one of the tallest in the world, and we all know that, but the basketball culture out here is not that good. And it's also due to the fact that, like we just discussed, how do we like let them experience basketball? How do we let them figure out stuff, and how do we let them learn? Because it's easy to kick a ball and start playing soccer. But yeah. Why do we have to make it so difficult to play basketball?
Yeah.
Like, how can we make that easy?
Yeah, so many barriers. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No,
that's nice. Well, Mike, thanks a lot for being here. I think this was a great episode. And for anyone listening, just any feedback, if you are still listening, it would be great to receive to keep on learning from maybe anyone. And Mike, that's it. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you for having me, man. Really awesome.